eligibility for federal benefits. More information at disasterassistance.gov.
Si fue afectado por los recientes incendios de Los Ángeles, le avisamos que se extendió hasta el lunes 31 de marzo el plazo para solicitar ayuda de FEMA, la Agencia Federal para el Manejo de Emergencias. Hay asistencia para vivienda temporal, reparación de vivienda y más. La ayuda de FEMA no se reembolsa y no afecta su elegibilidad para recibir otros beneficios federales. Hay más información en disasterassistance.gov/ES. This message is brought to you by Radio Bilingüe Public Radio.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Welcome, and I am Javelin Richard, a wonderful, happy Women's History Month, learning happy, joyous Women's History Month. And today we are going to talk about the ABCs of Women History Month. And my guest, Rio Cortez, is a Harlem-based writer whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The Miami Herald, and many other publications. She is also the author of the New York Times bestselling title, The ABCs of Black History, and The River is My Ocean. This is a very beautiful book that was also co-created with her artistic partner, Lauren Seamer. Hi, Rio, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So before we jump into the inner world of the ABCs of women's history, I have a couple of questions to ask you for myself and for the listeners who also think about themselves as women artists. There are two times in a person's life that's of deep importance. One is the day they're born, and the other when they realize why. Is this your why?
Oh, wow. What a beautiful framework for that question. I do think that poetry is my why, and I use poetry in this book and to tell this story. So in a way, I think the answer would be yes.
When were you introduced to poetry?
I've written poetry, and I've been interested in reading poetry since about third grade. I didn't grow up in a household with books of poetry or, you know, poetry on the minds of my family. But I was talking about this moment because I think it's interesting to think about finding inspiration in unexpected places. But when I was 10, John Singleton's Poetic Justice came out. I don't know if you remember this film.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the lead character is played by Janet Jackson, and she works in both a hair salon, but she also writes poetry in her journal. And in the film, the poetry that she narrates is written by Maya Angelou. And I just remember when I was that age, hearing Maya Angelou's poems and not knowing that words could do that, that they could have that kind of power and make you feel different things. And so that was the moment for me. After that, when I found out that it was Maya Angelou, I went to my school library and I checked her books out. And I think poetry just really captured my heart through that film, and it just stayed with me for the rest of my life, really.
Knowing that there was a time in history you just shared with us where poetry began for you, and inside of your book, The ABCs of Women's History, you have some profound women who have done greatness in their life. Greatness meaning that it moved things for themselves and other women.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say in a TED Talk? And excuse no one's a fan of TED Talk, I'm not necessarily, but just for you, for communication purpose, would you say to a room full of women folks who want to show up for their life or the social part of where we're at domestically and globally, why poetry can be a tool for that. When poetry inside of most of our learned experience is not always on the top of the list as resistance, as activism, and how can poetry, either reading, either experiencing it as a writer, that it does matter.
I think it's true that poetry can feel a little esoteric, and especially I feel like even in the moment we're in now, it can feel like a luxury, you know, like not quite a direct action. But for me, I would say, you know, that poetry is the synthesis and the most direct way to speak to truths. And so, you know, there's something about it that doesn't take up a lot of your time, but can have a lasting impact on you, both as a reader and a writer. I mean, I would encourage folks who are called to do so to write poetry also as a way to experience change in their lives. I think it's a place where you can put down and synthesize some of your, like, process what you're feeling, what you're going through, the world around you in a truthful way. And then I think also reading poetry really changes people's perspectives. It changes people's minds. It inspires people. It captures, like, instances of meaning and transformation. It certainly has changed me and the way that I think about the world. And it's called me to look at the world in a really different way. And so maybe, you know, I don't know that I've given the best pitch for poetry, but I would say that there's all kinds of forms as well, and all kinds of women who have used poetry to achieve change in the world. And so whether you're reading poets like, you know, Audre Lorde or Sonia Sanchez, who's writing from the Black Arts Movement, or you're reading more naturalist poetry or form of poetry like Gwendolyn Brooks, I think that they're all speaking to somebody out there, and that's such a worthwhile exercise and a transformational exercise if it's used in the right way.
Do you remember the first poem that changed you, the way you looked at the world?
Yeah. I wish I had it to pull up, but it is a really short Maya Angelou poem about touching hands. Mm. It's a really short stanza. It's like two words per line, maybe 8 lines long. And maybe in the course of this conversation, I'll find it. But yeah, I think the brevity of it was shocking. You know, I think sometimes we think long form storytelling is the way to make a big impact because we're getting a lot of information. And I actually feel like the opposite can be true, like that every word can hold like a whole universe, and that it could just work on multiple levels and do different things at once. And I moved and impressed by that. Many poems, I feel like I continue to discover poets whose work just blows me away. So
listening to you, Real, it reminds me of a time that I walked in a lecture hall in the university in the Midwest. So we're in the Midwest. And there was an instructor there who said, speaking about poetry, he said, a poem, for those who approach poetry and say, I really don't understand it, they feel intimidated by the experience. He was saying that a poem, to stay inside of that intimidation, stay inside the words, be with them, because poetry will hit you in your heart, in your soul, before it then begins to give you the words to articulate exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And once I heard that, for whatever part of me that had hesitancy with poetry or would read something, I don't get it, right? Then I sat with, and began to let go of the intimidation, but just play with the words and let them go in me and go out of me and read it, maybe another line in me, out of me, until it made whatever sense it needed to make sense to my soul.
I was just gonna say, you know, poetry doesn't require a solution all the time. It's a type of writing that, like, there isn't a correct answer to. So I think that's like such a perfect way to put that in a way, you know, and that there's a lesson in that too, that there's some knowing that exists beyond sort of the logic that we use in everyday life. It's like an intuitive knowing, and poetry can take us to that place, but it also isn't asking you to solve it, or it's not, you know, it's not a riddle. It's just like a presentation of an idea that that can hit differently for different readers. And so, yeah, I really appreciate how you put that.
Yes. Until now, we get a chance to go inside the ABCs of women's history. So tell our audience what this book is full of, and who were you thinking? We can give a general. I can just say the general, but tell me who you were thinking of that is general but not so general, and who you put in there to give the gifts to those who will be listeners to, readers of. Tell us that story, how you approached it, and why.
Yeah, so the ABCs of Women's History is our second project I worked on with Lauren, who you mentioned in your intro, who's an incredible artist. And we're both Black women and mothers. We live here in New York. And ABCs of Black History was really a love letter, in a way, to myself as a kid, and also to my daughter, just thinking about folks that I had wished I had known about when I was growing up. And when I wrote that book, I was at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and I was inspired every day by the archive there, and it sort of helped shape the content of that. And with women's history, it's the same. It's also kind of a love letter. It's a poem. It's told in rhyming verse. I felt like sometimes books about women's history didn't always speak to me as a person, as a Black woman, as a Puerto Rican woman. And so it was really important to me to create a book on women's history that could really honor those stories of Black, Brown, and Indigenous women in the collection. And so that was a big challenge for me, but it's similar. It's also a poem, and it's like such a huge subject, but it's, I would say that it's like the last 200 years, it's mostly centered on American history. And there are teachers, librarians, visual artists, musicians, writers, athletes, scientists, women in STEM and math, activists and organizers. I tried to include as many women as I possibly could in a book that's for this age range, that's 26 pages long. But yeah, that's what it is. It's kind of a love letter to women.
And it's a beautiful love letter. I'm looking at it, at the pictures now, and they're just absolutely, of course, they're colorful. The expressions that she caught on, the characters of people inside of that. And so here's something, if you're willing to do, I'd like to do.
Yeah.
If you could read a few pages, right?
Sure,
but here,
yeah.
before you read, I want our audience, our women listeners and all listeners, that when you mentioned about you growing up and I as a Black woman growing up and women growing up, in general, not always seeing our stories. They're not made up, but real stories of what we do, how we do, and why we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage for those listeners to take a moment to think about that inner child, that young child they were, as you read them the book. One of my favorite times was being able to hear teachers read stories. And then one of my unfavorite times in those times was knowing that it had nothing to do with me to a large degree. So it was a writing that was the best of times and the worst of times some other writer out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a chance to read, and I'd like our listeners to take a moment for whatever the circumstances that they were hearing poetry or a story read to them and they didn't feel quite inside the story. Now they can just listen and see if there's anything that they hear and they're being read to. and hopefully they find themselves however they come into the world. Okay, I turn it over to you, Rio.
Oh, thank you, Jacqueline. Should I just read a few pages?
Yes.
Okay. I'll read a few, and this is the letter A. I'll just read how it starts, because I think that's a good place to begin. So it's A is for anew. We step forward together with our history to guide us. We'll make this world better. As artists and activists, we've earned our seat at the table. As allies and leaders, we're willing, we're able. A is for abundance and all that we are meant to be, an affirmation to hold. I'm not just enough, I am plenty. Then maybe I'll read the letter S, which is such a beautiful spread Lauren has done. It's a one woman from the suffrage movement on the left side of the page, and on the right, it's a woman in the era of the Voting Rights Act passage. So it's S is for solidarity, for sisterhood, for suffrage. When it comes to new laws, we're part of the coverage. The Seneca Falls gathering redefined our roles, and years later, Ella Baker took up the fight for the polls. And then I'll read two more just toward the end. So I thought this page was really important to include for young readers. And it's why. Why is for you. Yes, you, in all your glory, you are uniquely part of the story. There's a future ahead and a path to claim. And most important of all, a place for your name. And then I'll just end with Z. Z is for zeal and the way history zooms before us. As Zora Neale Hurston believed, we are all part of that infinite, beautiful chorus. So that's just a taste. There's a lot of more specific spreads in the book.
Yes, and thank you for the choices that you made to share with us encourage us to think of the possibilities, and those possibilities being made because someone else made that possible, right? When did you start this? Because right, it sits so center of the story we're in now. When did this project start?
The project started, it took me about a year and a half, or between 18 months and 2 years to write. And I finished the manuscript, I finished the manuscript in 2024, early at the top of the year. And then Lauren has been illustrating for most of 2024, and then it just came out recently. So it's been kind of a journey, but also there've been so many landmark changes in our landscape that relate to women and women's issues in the span of when I first started writing the manuscript to the publication date, that it's been kind of remarkable, like the way that some of the messages are resonating or hitting differently today than they might have been, you know, when I started writing the book up to 4 years.
Which is why I asked that question, when did this happen? Like, did you wake up afterwards and think to the universe and whatever that language is for you, that oh, okay, this is the now that it needed to be okay.
Yeah, it has felt like there were things that I think in late revision that I felt like I really wanted to talk about. I don't know that 5 years ago it would have been as important. It wouldn't have felt as prescient for me to talk about, for example, choice and the women's right to choose. I mean, it would have been an important part of women's history, but it wouldn't have felt like the imperative that it did when I published this book, because of some of the reversals, you know, in Roe v. Wade. And it's just been, and then even at the top of the year, I don't know, I mean, however you're politically inclined, it would have been history making to have elected a woman president, like regardless of how you might feel about the candidate, it would have still made enormous impact in the story of women's history for her to have been inaugurated in January of this year. And so I think that's also something that, you know, has not been lost on me in the publication of the book. And yeah, it's just been such an interesting, it's just been such a fast moving, fast paced time in women's history that's like happening around us right now as we speak.
It really is. And the thing that I'm so appreciative of your work and how it's entered the story that we're all existing in, like you said, it's not about where people's political standing is. It's about the truth, but also about where we're at, though. I mean, the simple truths, right? Yes. And rights and voting and questions of the economy and war, all of those things, regardless of what people did in the voting thing, right? Mm-hmm. As you said, having a woman president would have made did a shift of consciousness, right?
Yes.
And then reading your work and what the ABCs of women's history also feels like it is, of all the things it's doing, I think it's also speaking to women who may not be, and folks who support women who may be feeling under the weight of it all, right? Mm-hmm. The seemingly as if our voices are not being heard or respected our in bodies.
Yes.
That it's reminding us, here are women long before this date and time in history that understood and lived in times when none of this was. When I say none of this, where there wasn't even voting, there wasn't even possibilities to do certain things, and to know that with less to work with less resources, what did they find in themselves to move forward, right?
Yes, I love that. Like a call to action, but also, you know, history is such a roadmap, and I think that's why that's why people sometimes don't want us to know our history, because of exactly what you're saying. If you withhold that information, you know, the ways that people have been able to improve their circumstances and gain freedoms and get justice and advocate for themselves, I mean, that has happened, and that we have had that like light our path in the past, and that we've gotten through challenging times, is a message that I think is so important for especially young girls and allies to read right now. And the efforts that are being made to sort of limit access to those stories only lets me know how powerful they can be, for the exact reasons that you're saying.
Yes, how powerful. And the rush to remove archives, the rush for to shut down like Black History Month, the rush to, and I'm not sure whether or not it's they've come after Women's History Month or whatever the story, just shutting everything down, will speak to all of us to know that the things, the doors people are closing, is are the doors that the systems that are not aligned with humanity are afraid to stay open, right?
Yes.
And so I just opened to one page that says, N is for no, never again. We are not going backward. Nope.
Yeah, I love that page. That was,
Right. And the beautiful artwork. So you just have this bouquet of women of different dress and skin tones and choices and colors and bringing it together to say that however we come to the table is so perfect in how we show up. And they're saying words like, nah, no puedo. That's used, no puedo.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Right. Yep. No, I'm good. Absolutely not. I don't think so. No, thank you. Never. I'm not interested. No way. And the attitude of it all, and I know this says five and up, I'm glad you said it, because certainly I believe that reading it to the household of five and up, and then also for grown folks to cuddle up with it and part of their whole practice, whether it's meditation practice, whether it's just curling up in bed and just being reminded that, my goodness, what did it take? But so many of our historical sisters, women, without resources that we have accessible, knowing what the odds was, knowing the isolation of some of those decisions without probably having others to be in that bouquet, but you're fighting for others, right? Like
yes.
to walk in. I just did a thing on Sojourner Truth and within a presentation and talked to the folks about what it felt like for this woman to walk in front of a room full of white men of different, what they would call a status,
mm-hmm.
and to question them.
Right.
Like, these are your criteria, right? These are
yeah.
your criteria. And this, but then here's another story. So now let's talk about this here, right? Like,
yeah.
What?
You know, what a powerful thing. I love bouquet too, your word bouquet.
Yeah. And most of us, the kind of courage it took to walk in front of a group of folks who just born into power just because of their gender and their color or whatever their story is, and they can just be. And then here this woman that comes in on the other side of that bookshelf and walk mm-hmm. in and be able to eloquently put down in front of them another truth,
mm.
another truth, like that kind of vibe. And I want us, as we're listening to you share some of the stories of the women and the heroes who already did most of the work for us, to ask ourselves what it must have taken, and then think about, we don't get the chance to exercise necessarily that part of us
mm.
that does exist.
Mm, that's right. Yeah.
Let's just talk about you for a second again. What does it, right? So I'm going to just say it in this way. How dare you walk in the world and call yourself a poet and prove it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I mean, or you, yeah, so many of us, but there, it's true. There's like this thing within all of us, this like, that we, you're right, don't have the opportunity to always exercise, where you're like, this is exactly who I am. And sort of like the first question you led with, you know, the why of why we're here, you know, like
yeah.
presenting that to someone else courageously. And when it's really the most difficult is an example. I mean, those examples are in this book for sure. And in the life of somebody like Sojourner Truth, absolutely. But yeah, how can that manifest in our own lives in small ways? And I think that's such a valuable question to be asking.
I am here having a wonderful discussion during Women's History Month with Rio Cortez. First of all, where can folks get you, and what is your website? If there's a website or your social media?
Yes. So the book is available anywhere books are sold. Like, you get it at your local indie bookstore or even the library. And I'm at riocortez.com. And I just have to say, Jeff, this has been like such a beautiful conversation. I don't think I've spoken to somebody who has used the language you use. I felt like it's been a very poetry forward interview. So I really appreciate you having me on and talking with me.
Oh, this has been my pleasure. So proud to be holding your book and putting it on my shelf and sharing it with others.
Cleaning up after wildfires like Los Angeles has experienced is hazardous. The ash and dust that remain can be toxic, since all kinds of materials were burned, including plastics, lead, asbestos, electronics, chemical products, and more.
Limpiar los escombros después de un incendio, como los ocurridos en el condado de Los Ángeles, es peligroso. La ceniza y el polvo que quedan pueden ser tóxicos, ya que se han quemado todo tipo de materiales, incluyendo plásticos, plomo, asbestos, aparatos electrónicos, productos químicos y más.
This is why wildfire cleanup can only be done by specially trained workers. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers can perform debris removal at no cost, but only after a right of entry form is submitted. The form can be found online at recovery.lacounty.gov, and the deadline to complete it is Monday, March 31st, 2025.
Por eso la limpieza después de un incendio en comunidades la deben realizar solamente trabajadores especialmente capacitados. Ingenieros del ejército están removiendo los escombros gratuitamente, pero solo para residentes que completen en línea una forma de derecho de entrada. Esta forma está disponible en Eliminación de Escombros, El Condado de Los Ángeles se recupera. Y la fecha límite para llenarla es el lunes 31 de marzo del 2025.
This message is brought to you by Radio Bilingüe Public Radio.
The benefits of donating your used vehicle to KPFK include funding new and existing programming, as well as increasing community awareness. You also benefit by being able to reduce your taxable income. There's no need to deal with the hassles of selling it, and you support public radio in the process. To donate your vehicle, please call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org.
Both fighters being called to the center of the ring.
Listen to my comments. Heads up.
I'm Salima Hamrani, and to start us off today, we're going to go back to August 1st at the 2024 Paris Olympics to a boxing match between Amani Khalif and Angela Karim.
A final welterweight fight of the session between Algeria and Italy, and we're off.
At first, Khalif and Karini weave back and forth, and Karini lands a punch. And then all of a sudden, Karini walks to the corner of the ring, and she pauses.
Karini just asking to get her head guard tightened in.
She comes back out to fight, and quickly, Khalif lands a punch.
Solid straight right hand from Khalif there.
And then all of a sudden, Karini quits. 46 seconds into the match, she retreats to the corner.
Well, demonstrating from Karini. She talks to her corner. She's not happy about something.
She's been shouting, "It's not fair, it's not fair." Meanwhile, Khalif looks sullen and worried.
We'll wait on the results here.
By abandon. Victorieuse by abandon. In red from Algeria.
Khalif wins this fight because Karini quits after one punch, less than 1 minute into the fight. But Khalif doesn't look triumphant in this moment. Her face looks confused. This fight, this 46-second match, began a firestorm in this year's Olympics. Almost immediately, commentators flooded Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Khalif, the Algerian fighter, they said, is not a woman. She's secretly a man. They argued that Karini quit because she was hit so hard by a man that she didn't feel as if it was fair to continue. She was in danger during the fight. Elon Musk and J.K. Rowling got involved.
Rowling using incorrect pronouns, tweeting that Khalif was enjoying the distress of a woman he's just punched in the head and whose life's ambitions he's just shattered.
Former President Trump jumped into the fray, saying that if he was elected, he'd forbid men from competing in women's sports. But here's the thing. Imani Khalif isn't a man. That's Khalif speaking out about the controversy later, saying, "I'm a woman, like any other woman. I was born a woman. I have lived as a woman. I compete as a woman. There is no doubt about that." So why did everybody suddenly become convinced that she was not a woman? That's the topic of today's show. The extreme focus on proving women's identities in sports. And to help us understand what's going on with gender in the Olympics, I sat down with Rose Eveleth.
I am the host and reporter behind a new podcast called Tested, which is about sex testing, past, present, and future, unfortunately, probably.
Rose has been investigating gender testing in sports, especially in track and field, for over a decade. Okay, Rose, so start us off. Why did people start making this accusation that Khalif was a man? Was it based on her appearance? Like, what was it?
So it's a couple things. I think some people will say things like, well, just look at her, right? Clearly, she doesn't look like a woman, which, of course, is completely subjective. The other thing that's happening here is that last year, in the spring of 2023, the IBA, the International Boxing Association, held a meeting and they disqualified these two boxers, Khalif and Lin. And they did so because they claimed that these boxers had failed some unspecified laboratory test about their gender. And it is still very unclear what test was done. They've gone back and forth. They've said it was testosterone, and then they said, no, it's not testosterone, it's chromosomes. It was all very confusing. But in the spring of last year, they disqualified these two boxers. And it was very strange because it was sort of in the middle of an event, the big sort of international tournament for boxing. And so because some people, I guess, knew about this past disqualification, they sort of resurfaced this idea that perhaps Khalif is not somehow a woman, which, of course, is not the case.
And why do they single out Khalif and Lynn?
We don't really know. It's I think, just based on appearance, right? I think it's that they seemed somehow not womanly enough. But it's not clearly written out in the meeting minutes what it was that flagged these two women in particular.
But also, the IBA has had its own controversies, right? Which have predated this particular gender scandal. Is there a reason we should be wary of what the IBA claims it discovered during those tests?
Yes. So the IBA is fraught, to put it maybe nicely. The IBA is the International Boxing Association. They used to be known as the AIBA. They've sort of gone through different iterations. And the IBA has been in hot water for many years, since about 2019, because there have been allegations of corruption, of unethical practices, of all sorts of things that actually have nothing to do with sex testing at all. They were already kind of in trouble. And so in 2019, the IOC actually gave them kind of a laundry list of things, saying, look, if you want to maintain your status as the recognized International Federation for Boxing, you need to clean up your act. You got to do this, this, this. And the IBA essentially didn't do those things. And so a couple of months after this meeting at which these two boxers were disqualified, the IOC stripped the IBA of recognition.
The IOC, the International Olympic Committee, has since come out in support of Khalif with a rare, very rare, progressive statement on gender.
They have competed and they continue to compete in the women's competition. They have lost and they have won against other women throughout over the years. The testosterone is not a perfect test. Many women can have testosterone, which is in what would be called male levels, and still be women and still compete as women. So this panacea, this idea that suddenly you do one test for testosterone and that sorts everything out, not the case, I'm afraid.
And keep those words in mind from the IOC, because that is not how they've normally thought about gender. Rose, so the other thing about the kind of like truly horrifying media obsession with Khalif's gender is that it's not new. And in your podcast, you talk about the earliest Olympics and how this immediately became a problem when the very first women began competing. Can you talk to me a little bit about the history of gender testing in sports?
Yeah, so one of the things I think is the most surprising about the history of sex testing is just how old it is, how long ago we started doing this. So in 1928, it's the first year that women are allowed to compete in track and field. Now, women had been allowed to compete in the Olympics before 1928, but they were only allowed in sports that were deemed at the time more feminine. So things like swimming or tennis. Track and field was seen as the manliest of man sports. If you were a real man, you competed in track and field. And so in 1928, when women are allowed to compete, essentially right off the bat, as soon as women hit the track, you hear people talking in newspapers, you know, quotes, all these headlines saying, there is something wrong with these women. That woman looks too muscular. That woman looks too strong. The woman who won silver in the 800 meters in 1928, Hitomi Kinue, who's a Japanese runner, people said things like, you know, she had all the power of a halfback, right? Talking about how they had these muscles. There was something wrong with them. And that sort of begins sex testing. So, you know, you have a couple of anecdotal stories about women being pulled aside. There was a story about Hitomi Kinue being pulled aside and examined. There's a story about Helen Stevens, an American runner, being pulled aside and examined. And then in 1936, you get the first sort of on-the-books policy for track and field saying that if there are what they called questions of a physical nature, you could take them aside and you could examine them.
Wait, when you say examined, what do you mean?
Yeah, it was purely visual. There's not a lot of good documentation about exactly what test would be done. And I sort of often don't even like to call it a test because really it is a visual exam. It means that you take someone aside and in the best case scenario, you ask them to go to their doctor and ask them to get like essentially a doctor's note that says, you know, we've examined this woman and she's a woman. But in the worst case scenario, you wind up with a sports official taking a woman aside and asking her to, again, get naked so that they can examine her body and make sure that, I guess, her vulva looks correct in some way. And again, this is not written down. They don't write down exactly what they'd be looking for. It's all very vague.
It should be pointed out here that the 1936 Olympics that Rose mentions were the Berlin Olympics, which took place during the height of the Nazi regime in Germany. At the time, there were huge boycotts asking the U.S. to pull out of the Games because of the Nazis. But while the persecution of Germany's Jewish population was taking place in the background, what were Olympic officials worried about? If the women were feminine enough. This has always been an underlying worry. Are the women competing feminine and attractive enough for men to want to look at?
Yeah, I mean, Avery Brundage, who is a really critical figure in the period of the 30s, 40s, even to the 50s, he's really the instrumental American sports official who pushes the United States to not boycott the 1936 Nazi Olympics, right? He is the reason largely that the U.S. stays in those games because he had a lot of friends in the Nazi Party and was quite sympathetic to the Nazi cause. You know, he talks fairly explicitly about one of the reasons why he doesn't like women participating in sports is because he finds it unattractive. He does not find it attractive to watch women exert themselves because when you run really hard, you know, you make a weird face and you look like you're trying really hard. And that was just sort of disgusting to him. And he doesn't really mince words about that. He's very straightforward about it.
But even in Nazi Germany, testing was on a case-by-case basis. And that changes in the 1960s.
And then in 1966, rather than abandoning sex testing, the governing body of track and field decides that actually they needed to test every single woman, that doing it on a case-by-case basis wasn't enough. And so they roll out something called the nude parades, which are unfortunately quite what they sound like. Women were asked to go into a room and get naked and be examined by someone, usually a doctor, that they don't know, to make sure that their basically genitals look correct and they looked like a woman. That also was called the peek and poke tests by some of the athletes at the time.
Rose actually managed to interview athletes who underwent the peek and poke tests for their podcast Tested. Here's Carol Martin, who was a young 18-year-old athlete at the time that she competed in Jamaica in 1966 at an international competition.
I remember we were taken under the stands before the competition into a large room and had to pull my pants down in front of this woman so she could see I had a vagina. I remember thinking, what the f*** is this? This seems a little invasive. This seems a little inappropriate.
This part was really astonishing to me in Rose's podcast because men have never undergone this kind of scrutiny, just women. The nude parades were incredibly unpopular for obvious reasons, and they were successfully banned in 1968. But by then, science had progressed, and we were able to start checking for testosterone and for chromosomes, which gave the IOC new tools with which to examine gender.
So between 1968-ish and 1999, every woman who competed at the Olympics had to go into a room, get their cheek swabbed, and take this chromosome test. And if you passed it, you were given a little card, a certificate of femininity, they were called. And then it would say, like, certified female, check. And you had to bring that with you to every event you wanted to compete at. But so then in 1999, they dropped that. And they drop it because there has been truly 30 years. I mean, basically since the very beginning, there have been doctors and experts begging the IOC to drop this test because it is not a reliable test of sex or gender. Having a Y chromosome does not necessarily make you a man. There are some estimates say 1 in 500 women have Y chromosomal material in some or all of their cells. You or I might have Y chromosomes. We might just not know because why would we know that? And so eventually in 99, they drop that test. And then in 2009, you sort of see this pick up again after Caster Semenya, who some people may know, ran in Berlin. And now we're sort of in this testosterone era where rather than thinking that the chromosome is the core thing, now we're really focused on testosterone. So it's been this kind of, I almost like to describe it as like a game of whack-a-mole a little bit, where there's everyone is just searching for this one singular test to tell who's a woman and who's not. And there isn't one. And so you just keep kind of hitting the moles as they pop out of the ground. And each one of them is their own kind of weird little test that we try to do. But there's just no way easily to do this.
Okay, but why can't we find one single test to tell us whether or not someone is a man or a woman? Well, because human sex is a beautifully varied, complicated thing, and there's no easy way to divide the sexes into a binary, no matter how much the IOC wants to. Stay tuned, we're going to dig into what makes a man and what makes a woman, or not, right after the break.
I'm jumping in to remind you that you are listening to Making Contact. If you like today's show and want more information, or if you'd like to leave us a comment, visit us at our new website, focmedia.org. There you can access today's show and all of our prior episodes. Okay, now back to the show.
Welcome back to Making Contact. Today we're talking about sex testing at the Olympics. In the first half of the show, we talked about the history of gender testing in sports and the incredibly invasive way women, not men, have been singled out in order to prove their gender identities. But while we might have social ideas about what makes a man and what makes a woman, in the biological realm, there's no clear binary. And we're back in the second half with Rose Evelyn, host and producer of the podcast Tested, which you can find links to on our website. Rose, there are a lot of components to biological sex that make us, quote, male or female. And I'm just curious, how common are variations? How many of us, for example, who identify as women might have high testosterone, for example, without even knowing?
Yeah, it's a great question that's actually hard to answer because, as you say, most people don't know, right, their chromosomal makeup, their testosterone level, right? Like, most people just don't know that. So we don't really know exactly how common it is, depending on the definition. So there's all sorts of things that can vary in human sex biology. You can have XXY chromosomes. You can have XYY chromosomes. Men can have XX chromosomes. You know, you can have internal testes but also have breasts and a vagina. You can have really high levels of testosterone. Some women have really, really high levels of testosterone, but they have what's called androgen insensitivity, and so they can't actually process that testosterone. So there's sort of a million different variations that can happen here. Intersex advocates sometimes call it sort of a symphony, right? That there's all different instruments that can get played to kind of combine to make whatever your sort of unique biological makeup is. And depending on who you ask and how you define these terms, there are some estimates that say that between 1 and 2% of the population has some kind of variation in their sex biology. So this is not exceedingly rare. It's not a super uncommon thing. And I think, you know, many people would perhaps be surprised to learn their biology. Actually, I was just talking to a neighbor of mine, and she told me that recently she was diagnosed with high testosterone, and she had her whole life, she had no idea. And she was joking. She was like, I'm not good at sports. You know, it didn't give me any kind of advantage. And so I think this is just actually far more common than people realize.
And then, of course, gender and sex are different concepts. You can be assigned one gender at birth, but know yourself to have a different identity than the one that you were assigned. The difference between sex and gender didn't exist as a concept back in the 20s and 30s, but there have always been trans people. And there was a consistent fear back in the early days of sports that if a woman was too athletic, she would spontaneously turn into a man.
So at the time, in the 20s and 30s and even into the 40s, there was this idea called balance theory. And you have to remember, this is before we really know very much about human chromosomes. So they had this idea that every person was born with basically like a little bit of man stuff and a little bit of lady stuff. And your balance was what sort of made your sex or gender. And so they believed that you could be kind of a 65% woman or a 90% woman. And what they worried about is that if you were already kind of maybe a what they called a borderline case, somebody who was maybe only 65% a woman, if you did things that men do, like, for example, play elite sports, you could actually shift your balance and you could tip over into maleness, quite literally turn into men. At the time, you see local newspapers reporting this where people would allegedly get sick, right? Get really sick, and then they would get better, and that sickness will have tipped them over. And so you'll see these sort of amazing articles where they say, you know, like, Johnny got really sick, and now he's Jane, and that's fine. And we're all fine with that, because we all know that's a thing that can happen, is you get sick, and it tips your balance, and then you become something else. And so you see these stories, essentially, of transition happening, but blamed on sickness that kind of balances, tips the balance. And so there was this worry that if you took these, again, borderline cases, and you allowed these women who were already kind of maybe close to the edge of being men, and you allowed them to compete in sports, they would accidentally turn themselves into men, and they needed to be protected against that.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, the newspaper articles of people transitioning, when I read them, they weren't as horrifying as I thought. And in fact, there was almost more of an acceptance of trans identities than there is now. Yeah, it is always a little bit both incredible and sometimes depressing when you see something like this, where you realize that perhaps, you know, 1920s ideas around acceptance of trans people are maybe we're in a better place than we are now, you know, not always great. And also it's sort of interesting, right? Because obviously balance theory is not like correct, quote unquote, scientifically, but in some ways it's actually spiritually or like philosophically much closer to the realities of human sex biology, right? Which is that it is a spectrum. There are all sorts of variations. It is not this really rigid binary where there is XX, XY, testosterone and, you know, estrogen. Like, you know, today I think people really have this sense of a very rigid, dichotomous, you know, sex binary. And that's not true. And in fact, balance theory, while certainly not accurate, is maybe a framing that is slightly more true in the spirit of the thing, in the sense that we have this spectrum that we're talking about.
Okay, so we have this 1 to 2% gender variation that is possible among all humans across all races, right? But you mentioned in your podcast that all of the women you talked to who were pulled aside for testing were Black and brown women from the global South. So what's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's a huge piece of this conversation. I think there are a couple of reasons why, when it comes to specifically people who are being flagged for what are sort of broadly called DSD, differences of sex development. When we talk about women who are being flagged and suddenly being told, like Khalif saying, like, you don't look like a woman, we're going to force you to test. As far as I know, there are no white women who have been in the last, since 2009, who have been flagged in this way. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that in most sports, these tests are not blanket tests. So we are no longer testing every single woman the way that we were in the 60s through the 90s. And so what that means is that there are only certain women who are being flagged as quote unquote suspicious. And that accusation often does come down to visuals, what somebody looks like. And there's a really long history of racist assumptions about who looks like a woman and what womanhood looks like, what femininity looks like. There is a very long, well-documented history of white supremacy essentially telling people that Black women, brown women don't look like women, that they look actually like men.
For example, non-white, non-Western women can sometimes have more body hair. That is enough to get you flagged for gender testing.
There's also, I think, another element here, which is sort of healthcare disparity. So in general, on average, and these are sort of sweeping generalizations, but babies that are born in the global north tend to be born in hospital settings and tend to be going to pediatric checkups and kind of have these what they call touch points to care, right? They're going to the doctor more. And in that case, often that means that if you do have some of these variations in sex biology, you might be diagnosed early.
And they're sometimes treated for it, which is highly controversial in of itself. Many women in the global south don't know that they have a difference in sex development until they're suddenly tested by the IOC. But that might be changing.
Because we're seeing a shift in the ways in which the global north thinks about these kinds of treatments, right? Because often those treatments involve things like genital surgeries to try and make them more like one or the other sex. And those are unnecessary and, you know, in some ways damaging. And so maybe I've heard people speculate that in 10 years, you're going to see a bunch of white folks who get into the same position where they're 18 and suddenly being told, actually, you have this thing and actually you need to, you know about it or change your body in some ways. And it will be very interesting to see if that changes the conversation that we're having right now. But that's another thing that's going on. So it's kind of both things in concert with one another.
Yeah. And again, given the variability in humans, why is there this extreme focus on women? Have men ever been scrutinized? I mean, there are probably men with low testosterone or high testosterone or intersex men competing in the Olympics too, right?
No. Men do not get questioned. Men can have as much testosterone as they like. Good for you. And that's fine. And the reason for that, when you ask about this, the reason that you get is that the male category is not a protected category. The women's category is protected. And we need to protect the women's category because if we didn't, then men would enter women's sports and they would win everything because men are better at sports than women. And so we need to protect the female category because otherwise it would be unfair to the real women who are competing in these groups. Because if you allow men or people with what they call male-like bodies or whatever other euphemism you want to use here to compete, it won't be fair.
Okay, so I've heard this before about the protected category. So the idea is that someone is secretly a man and that they're unfairly trying to win medals by competing in the women's category So we have to make sure that everybody in the women's category is actually a woman. My question is, has that actually ever happened?
At the elite level, as far as we know, no. So, you know, obviously there are like road races wherever, you know, who knows. But at the Olympic level, as far as I know, and I've been reporting this for many, many years, 10 years now, and I've talked to as many historians as I can, we have no evidence of any case of a man, quote unquote, masquerading as a woman. Now, we do have cases of women pretending to be men to compete because they've been barred from things like the marathon. So we do have cases of the reverse happening, but we do not know of any cases of at the elite level of men pretending to be women to compete.
Okay, so given all of this information, I have one final question for you. The binary in sports seems like it's pretty limiting. It also ignores a lot of human biology and sexual development. So how do we deal with this in the future? Do we get rid of the binary, or do we change the way that we organize athletes in, I don't know, weight classes or something?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And I think there are kind of different layers to it, right? And so I think the sort of baseline level is that if you're a woman, you should be allowed to compete in the women's category. And that, to me, goes for trans athletes as well as for, you know, athletes with DSD variations and all of that. Then there's this question, I think, of non-binary athletes, right? And I think there are, in some cases, it makes sense to give a non-binary category, right? For example, a couple of marathons and half marathons have opened up a non-binary category, and that's great. That is not something that you should force someone into. I've seen people suggest that, you know, these intersex athletes or athletes with sex variation should be just given their own category. And that feels quite othering, I think, to those women who say, you know, all the women I talked to for tested, they say, but I'm a woman. Like, they don't have any questions about their gender. They don't have gender dysphoria. But I also think that more big picture, when we talk about, like, what is the future of sports, it may be that in some sports, we should not have a gender binary and then everyone should compete together. It may be that in some sports we should, or that maybe we should think about dividing sports by some other category like height or, you know, weight classes like they do in boxing or something like that. And so I think that there are so many potential ways to think about this that can be really interesting, but that are hard to get at because we spend so much of our time debating the human rights of, you know, people who are don't fall neatly into these categories. And so I think there's all sorts of really interesting things that we could potentially talk about, but we're just not there yet because we're so stuck in this other muddy part.
That was Rose Ebelith, producer and reporter for the podcast Tested. And because we started the show with Imani Khalif, we just wanted to end with an update. In the final of the women's welterweight division, Imani Khalif, the Algerian, fought Yang Liu of China. And in a unanimous decision from all five judges, Khalif won gold.
Gold medalist and Olympic champion. In red from Algeria, Imani Khalif.
But it's not the end of the controversy over her gender.
The Algerian boxer filing a criminal complaint with Paris prosecutors to get to the bottom of the, quote, misogynistic, racist, and sexist campaign against Khalif, according to her lawyer.
Khalif specifically names Elon Musk, J.K. Rowling, and J.D. Vance, and she doesn't have to prove her gender in court. This is not a defamation hearing. She's taking them to court for online harassment. It's a big deal in an era when athletes' lives can be ruined over social media.
And we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Feminist Magazine is produced by a coalition of feminist volunteers. Don't forget, you can find all the links from our program today on our website, feministmagazine.org. Our programs are archived in the kpfk.org audio archives. You can find our podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Mimi Kennedy. As a longtime listener and supporter of KPFK and sometime guest, I don't think I've ever felt this station was needed more than it is now, in LA and across the globe. We in LA know KPFK has created community here, and it's up to us now to protect and sustain it. Think of where you get your news, your music, your connection. Phone and cable bills are through the roof, but for $5, $10, $20 a month, you can sustain this station and nourish this community. Go to kpfk.org/donate or call 818-985-5735 and press option 2. With 500 sustainers before the April Fund Drive, that drive will be shorter and KPFK will be stronger. KPFK.org/donate or 818-985-5735. And let's keep listening, let's keep supporting this station, and let's keep looking with hope towards a better time and a media that is truly free.
Support for KPFK comes in part from the Lemley Theaters, presenting Far Out, Life on and After the Commune, April 5th through the 7th at 5 of their L.A. theaters. A portion from the ticket sales will help fund KPFK Radio. The documentary's filmmaker, former Commune member Charles